Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The News in Review. We're going to be discussing three cases today. Two are national stories, and the third is one that seems to have fallen through the cracks, but is happening on our back door. So we definitely are going to be following it. I also want to wish everyone a very happy and very safe 4th of July. Joining me in the studio is my wife, Jan.
Hi, everyone, and happy 4th of July. I hope everyone stays safe.
Jan, have you got any fireworks for us this week?
Oh, several of them.
Oh, goodness.
No, not really.
from the state of Maine, we have investigator Peter Hyatt. Peter, great to talk to you again.
Well, thanks for having me back, Simon. Hello to everyone.
Peter, what are your 4th of July plans? Have you got some lobster-shaped fireworks to launch?
We sure do, and shrimp on the barbie, and beautiful, sunny, 90-degree weather here. Just beautiful.
Hmm. Makes me quite envious.
We've got hot weather, too, Simon.
Yeah, but we don't have lobsters or shrimp on the barbie.
Sure. All I'm saying is in hot weather.
From upstate New York, we have the crime doctor himself, Denny Griffin. Denny, how are you spending the 4th? Are you having a barbecue with some of your ex-gangster friends and watching reruns of The Godfather?
Now, actually, we had a little some festivities yesterday, and today we're just kind of coasting. And but I do have the nice weather here, too, as Peter's experiencing, so that's a treat.
And lastly, joining us is Dave Knackle. Dave is a blogger who follows many of the current crime stories. Dave, always good to talk to you.
Very much my pleasure, Simon. Hello, everyone.
Dave.
TJ Hart cannot be with us today. He's spending the afternoon in what I can only describe as purgatory. He's at a large water park. He's hanging out at the VIP booth, doling out free ice cream to the children. TJ, have a great 4th of July. I just can't think of a better way to spend it.
Well, at least he's with ice cream to keep him cool.
But he's not allowed to eat it. He has
no,
to watch his weight.
No, but he handles it.
As always, our phone lines are open, and we welcome your questions and comments. The number to call is area code 646-378-1120. Or you are welcome to hang out in our chat room and ask your questions there. That actually might not be a bad solution this afternoon. Okay, on with the program. Jan, I have a question for you. What happens when someone goes missing and they are not some adorable young child?
Oh, well, some places apparently you have your file sitting in the police department, the sheriff's office, or DA's office, and it gets quietly put in the back to where it can collect some dust and just forgotten about if they have their choice.
The case that Jan and I have spent considerable amount of time on this week concerns a young man. He was 26 years old, named Zachary Pittman, and 11 o'clock at night, he disappeared from rural Louisiana, never to be seen again. There's been absolutely no press coverage, and quite frankly, no one seems to care. I mean, Jan, were you shocked when we first heard of this?
Definitely I was shocked. I mean, this is right on our back door. I mean, we've covered cases before, but this is a little close to home, and it really affected me. I mean, it just goes to show you, it goes around all over. It's not just in one spot.
In fact, Jan, why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch of the Zachary Pittman case?
Okay, Zachary Pittman was 26 years old. On June 24th of this year, made exactly 1 year ago, that he disappeared from his father's home where he was staying, and nobody has seen or heard from him since then. He had apparently had a small fight with his sister, and it was nothing really big deal, no big deal with the argument, but it's like any argument that goes on with siblings, and she just didn't want to put up with him anymore. So she called the cops because she wanted him to leave. And she went to her bedroom, and that was the last she saw her brother. And nobody can explain where he went. He left the house. He had flip-flops on. I think it was a pair of shorts and a dark-colored T-shirt, and that's the last they've seen him. They have no idea what happened to him. He was carrying a backpack, but nobody has seen him since then, and getting cooperation from some of the people is really, really hard to do.
In fact, it's worse than that. He had no money.
Right.
He had no car. He had no cell phone.
Right. No driver's license. I don't think he had his driver's license with him either.
No, he didn't.
But still, and where he lives is definitely not in a crowded neighborhood. So it's back in a separate area. There were houses around, but not right next door to him. So if he had to walk, if he was walking somewhere, I just don't understand where he could have went to that fast, because the cops were there supposedly 5 minutes afterwards, according to the girl that he was with. She left, and she told the cops that she left, and he told her to come back in 5 minutes. But within that 5 minutes, he was gone, out of sight, never seen again.
Peter, I know this is outside of your purview. Where would you start with something like this? That there aren't any statements to analyze because there aren't any statements.
Yeah, as we talked about before, this would mean some very tough and difficult questions for the family. So I need everyone's cooperation in the family. I would prefer, depending on how large the family is and the extended family and friends around them, I would prefer to actually go the route of a questionnaire where each of them are able to answer certain particular questions regarding, which would show their feelings about this disappearance, but also the day that he went missing, to cover that day. And Simon, I'll tell you what, if you have in the questionnaire that's even used by the federal government, it is so effective. It was designed by Avinon Sapir, originally from Israel. It's so effective that if you have 100 of them given out, instead of having to conduct 100 interviews, it would likely clear, on percentage-wise, 75 to 80 of them, so that 15 to 20 or 20 to 25, somewhere in that number, would need to be interviewed. So it's a great time saver, and it has been proven to be as about as effective as a polygraph machine. And obviously we can't sit down with everyone and polygraph them. So this would be my start on these type of cold cases, is to begin to get some tough questions out there, some detailed questions, and see their reaction, see their disposition towards the fellow that went missing. And that would probably give us a good idea, because people do not vanish into thin air.
Denny, what's your thoughts? Where would you start?
Well, I think Peter hit on it. Certainly people don't just vanish into thin air. Something happened to this fellow. He went somewhere. Somebody knows something. And a cold case, I'm working on something similar to this now. And I would love to be able to get that questionnaire Peter referred to out to some of the people that were in a position to know what happened. I don't know if they would be responsive, but I certainly would love to get it out there, because the police investigation initially was, in my opinion, was a little bit lacking. And I think these people who have or are in a position to have information, at the minimum, I'd love to see them answer at least a questionnaire and then see who we would want to follow up on with perhaps personal interviews if we can get the cooperation of the people.
Yeah, actually, Peter, I would like to talk to you. Maybe we can talk about this tomorrow, and let's get something like that rocking and rolling. Jan and I certainly have the distribution list, shall we say.
How large is it?
I'm sorry, Peter?
About how large is the list, you think?
Oh, probably 20 people, and I suspect 10 of them won't talk to us.
Okay. In reflecting back from what Denny was doing there, I've been assisting Denny on one of the cases he's working on, and I'll tell you what, if I was in a difficult position, as the family might be, I'd want to contact Denny because his dogged determination, I think, is going to bring some answers. He's looked at a police investigation that was not so much skewered, but just terribly weak and terribly ineffectual. He's seen the things that were not done, including working with the military, and he has got a team of people that are pressing, and that's sometimes what's needed, is make some noise and put some pressure on these folks and get some answers out there.
Okay, let's talk about pressure. I mean, that's actually a very good segue. Yesterday, Jan and I sat down with Zach's mother, Christy Ragus, who I was hoping was going to be joining us today, but looks like she's unavailable, and another person who I think I'll just not name at the moment, and we discussed it at some length. What did you make of that conversation, Jan?
Very interesting. You're talking about the one here yesterday?
Yes.
Well, we found that, you know, we had covered a lot of the conversation, and it was, like I said, well, y'all went and visited the area and stuff, and whatever. You got more information on that than I did.
Yeah, after we had chin-wagged, we decided it was time to take a little road trip. Pearl River is only about 20 miles from where we live.
I don't think it's that far.
No, probably not. And so we hopped in a truck and headed off to the wilds of Pearl River. It was quite an illuminating afternoon. And I do believe that on the phone we have Christy Ragus with us. Christy,
yes.
Is that you?
Yes, I didn't know if you could hear me or not. I'm
Hi,
on
Christy.
A cell phone.
Hey, how you
we
doing?
We can hear you good.
Okay, for now.
we were just discussing yesterday's road trip. What did you make of it?
I got a kick out watching you, Simon, actually. You were just amazed at everything. I'm just so used to it over here. The trip was, though, it was interesting. And, you know, seeing you see everything in a new light, it was really interesting because I'm just used to the area, you know, being around here, especially all year round.
Well, that was his first trip to the swamps.
Oh, yeah. And
oh,
actually,
yeah, I need to explain to some people here. You know, I'm not saying that I'm a city boy, because I'm really not. But
yeah.
You know, the swamps are not my favorite spot to hang out. I don't know nothing about them, and these folks lead me, you know, 10, 15 minutes into, you know, some really, really deep undergrowth, and they're giving me advice like, you know, don't pick your feet up high because the snakes will get you. You know, there's a banana spider. They're really mean. Oh, my goodness, is that an alligator hole? Oh, it was just a wonderful wildlife experience, and then I hear, oh, check this track out. That's a hog. That's a wild hog, and it's a big one.
Yeah, that's the one we saw last week, and it's about 300 pounds, and it just walked out in the open. It was nothing. So, yeah, needless to say, I wouldn't go use the bathroom in the woods.
Yeah, but. so that was kind of how I spent a good deal of my afternoon. I mean, the only thing I did like in the swamp was I got to see this tiny little turtle. It was only about 2 inches long, and it looked absolutely harmless. And everything else just scared the willies out of me.
Yeah, well, when those little turtles get big, it should scare the willies out of you, too. Those are snappers, most of them. I mean, that's what you saw. And they get pretty nice size up there.
What really surprised me was when we weren't in the swamp, we actually took a drive around the area that Zach disappeared from. And we took a number of photographs, some of which I have published, and some of which I have not published. We seem to have gained everyone's attention. As I understand it, Christy, you received a phone call about an hour after we had left.
Yeah, I had actually called to check on my daughter, and she said, anything going on? And she said, yeah, they have two sheriff's department cars riding around. And I said, oh, they're looking for me. But we didn't know what they were ever looking for, but more than likely it was. They just passed one, she said, but there are two of them, and they were probably looking for us. I'm sure the guy called the police on us, so I'm not worried about it because we didn't do anything wrong. So, anyway.
No. And there's one particular photograph that I won't publish, or at least not completely. But the more I look at it, and we have zoomed in, it does look a lot like he's carrying a pill bottle in his right hand. I wonder why that might be.
I don't doubt it, but I mean, who's to say if it's legal or not? But that's what the type of people they are. That's what they do, 24/7. You know.
Okay, Peter, I want to bring you in on this one. You have covered the Haley Cummings case extensively. I thought that Satsuma was the drug capital of the world, but we might have found a new one. Do you think that drugs are everywhere in America? You know, is this the route that we're taking?
It certainly feels that way. We are here in a small town in Maine, and we have, I'm going to guess at this point because it changes, 4 or either 5 methadone clinics here. And that's a business, and it's run like any other business, but the fact that a city of maybe 30,000 people could have 4 or 5 methadone clinics tells you quite a bit. But the dynamics of the investigation would have to have drugs as a basis for what we're starting with. There's no question. It's become just an epidemic in our country.
Denny, I know that for many years you were an investigator, and your particular area of interest was the medical field. I mean, what do you make of the drug epidemic that we seem to be, under siege with at the moment?
Well, epidemic is probably an appropriate word. It seems to me, and I've been out of the business for quite some time, but it seems to me it's getting virtually out of control, and it's there's obviously big money involved, or we wouldn't be having, I don't think, quite the problem we're having. So people are making big money on it, and it's got to be brought under control somehow, because it's nothing but bad news. But Simon, let me just stop for a second. We were talking. You asked before Chris got on the phone with us about, you asked Peter where he would start in an investigation of Zach's disappearance. And one thing I wanted to ask, I know you said at the start of the show that there are no statements to analyze because the police didn't take any statements. However, I just came across a document in the case I'm working on, and it was an investigative summary. And in that summary, the detective assigned to this particular case tells some are specific dates, other or more or less what happened during the month's time frame, but tells the different people he spoke with and gives his version and his words of what they had to say. I was wondering, does something like that exist in Zach's case? Was there an investigative summary or synopsis that was made up that tells what activities law enforcement did to try to find out what happened with Zach?
Well, that I know of, they were called in. There was quite a few people that was questioned extensively, one for 6 hours. And the only people that I know were brought in were the girl that was with Zach. And he's questioned a few of the other people, and she's the only one that was given the lie detector test. And I'm trying to think. But at first, they were bringing people in. And one particular person they brought in for 6 hours was the person that Zach had went to the doctor with. And, you know, because he was seen with Zach the day before. And I told the police this. And I told them that, you know, where he went to the doctor. It was a methadone clinic where he had gotten his prescription filled and where he cashed his check. So I know those people were questioned because they told me. You know, I had talked to the people. And, of course, Chastity and my daughter.
Would it be safe to think then that perhaps there were some actual statements taken? You said somebody was polygraphed.
Yes.
But it would be a matter of getting the statements as opposed to that they don't exist?
Well, why would they? But why would they want to release them? That they're not part of public record because no charges have been filed.
Right.
Sometimes, Simon, sometimes the departments will allow another investigator to take a look at the statements. In the case of Kyron Horman, I've offered to help there, but the issue then becomes privacy and confidentiality, where we can't always share some of the findings. But I think Denny's onto that in the sense that if they have spoken to people, even informally, they have at least notes of those discussions, perhaps even interviews, if not some recordings. So there should be enough material to take a look at. And as with the questionnaire and as with statements, what we're looking for is areas of extreme sensitivity where we can say that the subject of the interview has withheld relevant information. And that's something that is, in a scientific form, is definitive. We find areas, we don't always know what's being withheld, but we know if a particular subject is sensitive, and we know in an area where information has been withheld. So I would imagine that there may be some similarities between the methadone clinic down there and some that I've worked with here in my area, where there's a lot of activity going on outside, out and about and around that, because most people on methadone are there daily, at least for the first year or two, where they go every single day. After that, they get to take home privileges and that sort of thing. But that means a lot of interaction and a lot of contact between people, and that can give us some answers about what may have happened.
Dave, I know that you have absolutely no knowledge about this particular case. What would be your theory? You know, how should we move forward?
You talking to me, Simon?
Yes.
Okay, I'm on board with Peter. I think the people who are in a position to know need to be talked with. If the police haven't done it or haven't done it adequately, certainly they need, and like Peter said, that the particular questionnaire he referenced at the start of the show can rule out or clear.
I was trying to get hold of the other Dave. Dave Neckel.
Okay.
Oh, yes, here I am. If with this prescription for methadone, was the prescription still in the house? You didn't take that with him.
Okay, this is Zachary. Previously, I had doctors. I was bringing him. This is months and months before to a clinic in Mandeville for Suboxone, and Zach would take Suboxone and made him feel normal. He said Zach was ADD or ADHD, I guess / bipolar, and he said, "Mom, it would make me." He would tell me it'd make him feel right. Now, when I found out he went to the methadone clinic, I was kind of shocked. I mean, I knew he did it every now and then, but apparently he got the money up, and they all, I guess with these guys, they get the money up to let one person go, and they went. And, I mean, this is all, I'm the one that told the police everything as soon as, you know, it happened. I told them everything. I didn't hide anything. And apparently I'm sure he was taking some of it, but I was told that, at that night by this girl, that he only had a couple of pills on him. She told the police a different story. And I would think that because Zach had no money that he would try to cut, you know, sell some of them. You know, I'm not disputing it. Probably he could have hurt because of the drugs. I don't know. In fact, you were talking about a statement being written. Zach had the first investigator. He is no longer in the case. It was moved to major crimes. And Corey is the investigator, and he has a accordion file he keeps with him. Everything is documented. He did tell me that, as far as I know. I mean, he's pretty open with me, pretty much. I talk to him, you know, a lot. But that with the methadone, I was kind of surprised because I knew he did it every now and then. He told me that. I mean, he told me everything he did. And that's the kind of relationship I had with my son. I tried to help him. But I was kind of... You know, I didn't know that he had went to the doctor until I found out.
Well, see, my thought was, would somebody have come along knowing that he's got this prescription or something, and they attack him because they can get that drug out of his hands?
Could be. We don't know. I mean, that's just it. We don't. He got into an argument with my daughter, and she went to the back room. This girl that was with him, she said that Zachary told her to come back in 5 minutes. She said Zach went out the door. And he has not been seen or heard from since then. It's just strange. She passed back by the house, and the police were there. I'm the last person to talk to my son. He called me at 11:16 at night and said, "Mama, Lindsay called the police on him." And she did that because she just wanted him out of the house. They were arguing. And they do that
I looked on a map, and I saw it's kind of like a loop street that you live on.
That's a loop. They have two loops off that Archie Singletary Road.
I just want to know, which way do you think he would have gone?
I think, personally, there's three houses he could have gone to. Personally, I believe, this is my opinion, that, and of course, you know, they all did kind of, you know, hung around, did drugs, stayed up late. I think he either used the phone, or he was lured into one of these places. Somebody knows what happened. I don't care, you know, I can even accept that my son OD'd, but where is it? We have searched the areas, and this is a lot of hunting leases, and with cadaver dogs and everything, and I feel he is not around there. I really don't. And you know, even if he was hiding until the police left, came back and supposedly got his, and this doesn't make sense. It don't make sense at all.
No, it doesn't.
If she was polygraphing, I don't know the questions. Then I think, and they had.
You wouldn't think that somebody would be out there lurking, waiting for him to come out of the house. That's what makes it sound so, it looks even seems so usual. I mean, they wouldn't be parking their vehicle somewhere in hopes, when I saw that loop, which way he would go. So if he took the long way.
No. You're missing a very, very key component here. What happened 2 days prior to this, Christy?
I'll back up a couple of months before. Zach was at one of the houses down the street from his father's. He's sitting on a porch, and somebody came in the back of him and hit him in the back of the head. And this person was very upset with Zach. Said, he said, "I'm not going to fight you. I don't fight older people." He's in his late 40s. And he was seeing the girl that Zach was with the same time. And, you know, Zach kind of hung around with her for a ride. He, you know, didn't have a ride or anything. He was trying to get a job. He was working a job part-time doing painting. And so he said, look, man, I'm not going to, you know, fight with you. And then after that, I found out like 6 months later after Zach was missing, my son happened to hear about Zach getting in a fight 2 days prior to him missing. So I called the detective, and he goes, yeah, you know, Zach got into a fight, you know, with this person, and Zach beat him up. I guess he just got tired of it. I don't know. But also there was something, I don't know if Simon's talked about, Zach had talked about, he described this place to me to a T, this nice new trailer he was going to move into, which is outside of Clyde, Appalachia. After Zach was missing, I went over to this girl's house, and he was moving furniture, and I said, is any of Zach's stuff over here? And he said, no. He goes, oh, me and Zach are cool. He's talking to my face and my daughter. You know, I hope you find them and all that, and he was telling me that. Well, they moved into the trailer Zach was planning on moving into, and it really, really upset me. And he sat there and did not mention one word about the fight. Of course, he's not gonna. But I talked to the detectives, you know, all the time about this, and they really don't think, you know, it's not a motive. I mean, I have a difference of opinion. I mean, I just can't come out and blame somebody, but I feel strongly about it that, you know, to me, you know, he's pissed off because Zach is this girl. I mean, that's motive.
Okay, but one last question. I'm sorry to put you on the hot seat here, but who did this gentleman move into the trailer with?
In the trailer with the girl that Zach was with.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
That was the girl, and he is the son of a political person, but...
that's what I was kind of wondering.
He doesn't have anything to do with his family. I know that for a fact by several people. And, you know, his father is kind of dismissing. And I'm not blaming his family because they are good people. And, you know, you can't control what your children do. Obviously, look at me. You know, I tried. I tried to help my child. And no matter what, I'm trying to blame them. I just don't find them. And then I worry about justice. You know, before anything, they can answer to God. So if somebody knows something, and I will find them one day. I will. It's just frustrating because we basically we're doing everything ourselves as far as the searches because St. Tammany Parish doesn't really have the search team. They are using borrowed people. And I guess the manpower, if you want to call it, not too many people working on the case, which there's no evidence of foul play, and there's no evidence it's not foul play. So it's in a spot. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to make people look. He's not here. I mean, he didn't run off. He did not. He had a gorgeous 3-year-old daughter. He would never leave.
Denny, this sounds like the perfect material for Crime Wire. I mean, what are you making of this story as it unfolds?
Well, let me. Did I understand Chrissy correctly that there's, as far as she knows, they don't have evidence. That, when I say they, I mean the law enforcement. There's no evidence of foul play, but they have put the case in the major crimes unit. Am I correct on that?
It was moved to major crimes about 6 weeks after he was reported missing. He was gone June 24th. I reported a few days before him, June 2nd. On July 7th last year, I had a search party out here at my husband's house to search to see if he did OD. You know, it takes approximately, I guess, 30 minutes to OD. You know, just give or take. I mean, I've gone through every scenario there is. This goes through my head every night. What could have happened? I never rest. And I don't understand. Well, because there's more manpower, supposedly major crimes, more time, which I don't buy. But they feel, well, the detectives, they know that he's not alive. I mean, they can't tell on record. In fact, they're telling the bondsman, well, you know, Zach had been in previous trouble over a fight that I had gotten him out. Well, my daughter had gotten him out, and he's telling the people, look, he's not a fugitive. He's not a fugitive. I mean, he knows he's not a fugitive. We don't know what happened, but we know he's deceased. I knew that. And, I mean, this is just the mother. I knew the feeling that night or right after. I knew it. I knew something happened, and, I mean, that's just me. But if time goes by, I'm right. I don't want to be right. I would love to find them, you know, with amnesia somewhere, you know, or something. But it's in all the systems and NCIC system, and, you know, I've done everything I can to get exposure.
Simon, let me clarify. You mentioned a minute ago I was talking about statements, and you said that why would the police want to release the statements? And I just want to clarify this. In the case I'm referring to and that Peter has been helping me with, there were three agencies involved total. This was a soldier. So there was the CID from the fort he was stationed at got involved initially. Their case is now closed. And they are the source of the statements that Peter has looked at. The civilian law enforcement, it's currently with one agency now. It's the county sheriff's department. And they have treated this. They said the case is inactive. It's been active since 2008. However, it is not closed. So they are not releasing anything in the way of statements. The deceased soldier's mother was able to get the detective handling the case to prepare this narrative or summary synopsis of the investigative effort, but not release any of the statements that were taken or any of the details. So what we have, there's some little nuggets of information in there describing the activities of law enforcement, civilian law enforcement, but they have not, the civilian law enforcement has not released any of the statements, and they made it quite clear that because this is being carried as a, it's not a closed case, it's only inactive, that they are hanging their, that they're not going to release any statements until the case is closed, even to the mother. So this investigative summary or synopsis or that we have is probably all we're going to get from the civilian law enforcement at this point.
Christy, before you joined us this afternoon, Peter actually mentioned an investigative tool. It's just a questionnaire. Peter, do you want to run that by Christy and get her feedback?
Christy, it's a very simple questionnaire, and its purpose is to clear away the debris of anyone who doesn't have information regarding his disappearance and to narrow down the focus on who does. It's a document that it scans for sensitivity, and it would allow us to know if there are people that are connected to his disappearance that have not been forthcoming. Not so much that they're lying, but they've not told everything that they know for whatever reason. It may be personal, it may be nefarious, but it allows us to know who we need to have real strong interview or conversation with. It is something that we give out to everyone so no one feels personally insulted. It has been used, I think the highest number in a controlled test was used in the U.S. Army, 500 of them at one time, and all 500 subjects were also given a polygraph. And the results were identical. It's a stunning tool. And it just, you know, questions, for instance, might be, on the day that he went missing, could you please account for that day, starting from the time you woke up to the time you went to bed? And then we leave about two pages for them to fill in. That one question alone will tell us if this person has any information regarding this. You have heard about him going missing. How would you account for this? How would you conduct an investigation? That's just a very simple question that we ask people. We ask them this, believe it or not. We ask them, have you told us the truth? And there are certain answers that will fall into a statistical category of truthful people, and there will be certain answers that do not fall into a statistical category of tell me the truth, and we will follow up with them. One thing I will tell you about, if it's fascinating, is that there was a detective who used this tool for many years. One day, evidence money, a lot of it, went missing. And he, like others, had to fill out the same questionnaire that he had been using and knowing the answers, knowing the statistics, and it still caught him as a thief of money. So our words do give us away, and if someone knows more than they've been telling, if someone has been withholding information, we can find that out for you. So we'd like to help with any way if I can.
They would have to volunteer, though, right? You can't just ask somebody to do it. They would have no. That's the whole thing. He was telling me, as far as the lie detectors, he can ask them to do it, but they can deny it, and they don't have to do it because there's no for them to take a lie detector test.
As a matter of fact, one of the ways we address that is really simple. Is we say, if someone refuses us, that's fine. We're not here to pressure anybody, but.
Right.
Do you have a reason why you would like to refuse to do this? Is there a reason why you'd not like to help us? And that itself creates suspicion. So I have found, and I think this is probably the norm, is that most people will do the questionnaire. Our ego and pride tells us that we're smarter than everyone else, and when we fill something like that out, we think we're giving out the answers we should be giving out, and no matter what, I've had them filled out with lawyers present. That doesn't change a thing for me. I don't mind. That's fine. And we still get the information we need. So if someone refuses, we'll just take careful note of that, of who would refuse. I would find it very unlikely that anyone would refuse because it's just it's very unintrusive.
I question him specifically about, he says, well, I don't want to keep asking people because I don't want runoff. You don't want to, I guess, borderline harassment, and he doesn't want to push him. I don't know, he might have a reason why, especially the one he got in a fight with. That's one of the ones that I wanted questioned, you know, extensively. and especially another one that got caught taking the signs down. I mean, to me, that's suspicious activity. But he's saying, no, they're just paranoid and they're mad and this and that. And he might see things differently than I do. I mean, I'm just a mom and I'm looking at everything. You know, I'm looking for anything. And that's just, and I know that. I mean, and he's in law enforcement, he knows what he's doing, and I trust him. I really do trust him. He's been there for me.
If you could get Corey to talk with us, you know, maybe, you know, Peter and I could come up with a good reason why he might want to... go down this pathway.
Well, I mean, Peter, you're in law enforcement, or you were ex. I missed that. I didn't hear it. I'm sorry. He might.
That's
possibly...
okay. I'm a state investigator. I'm an investigator for the state of Maine, and the I find that many investigators are more than happy to receive outside help.
He might talk to you.
There's not always that mentality of that we don't need anyone's help and this sort of thing, because it's frustrating.
Right.
But the questionnaire is a time saver. And I would like to mention this as well, because it may have to do with the clinic. Is that Suboxone? It was Suboxone he was on. Is that correct?
Yes, and it was a clinic in Louisiana and another town.
Yeah,
so.
That's an opiate agonist antagonist, which means that that can be taken probably like 24 hours after the last heroin dosage, or even 48 hours after the last methadone dose. That kills off the withdrawal pains that heroin addicts will go through. Those little tiny pills, very tiny 0.2 milligram pills, are of extreme value to addicts. And when someone is desperate enough, they will become violent to take that from someone. So that was mentioned earlier about the possibility. And I think that's something that would need to be looked into.
Well, I know...
So I'd like to see if we can distribute them even to the...
He never used heroin. I knew that. He always, I guess, opiates, the methadone... that, and then he was on Suboxone, and like I said, then this time, then I had questioned him, and he would tell me what he was on. He would always tell me, and I just took this month, or take one, or something, you know, I had to, you know, this is what he'd tell me, and he was straight up about it, you know. When he got into an argument with his sister that night, you know, she said that he was enraged, you know, and that's why she wanted him to leave, because he, you know, it was over something stupid. It was really stupid. And she says, I'm not going to fight with you. And, you know, he wouldn't leave. She just wanted him to leave. They both lived here, lived at their dad's house. And she went to the back room. And, you know, she had called the police, and that's when he called me. And when I talked to him, he didn't sound bad. He just said, Mama, she called the police on me. You know, I didn't do anything. You can ask Chastity. I didn't do anything. I said, well, Zachary, I don't know what to tell you. I'm up and, you know, working with my husband. We were out of state. And all of a sudden, the phone went quick, and that's the last words I heard of my son. And his state of mind that night, if he was on something, he was upset with his sister, and then he's probably depressed because he knew he was going to hear from his dad.
The Suboxone works also with depression.
Yep.
That's one of the things that it alleviates that. So it may have been that he might have been beginning to feel some effects of withdrawal and beginning to get agitated, and she saw the signs coming that here we go again type thing, and she doesn't want to deal with it, so she says get out.
And
I understand that, but people in those clinics, they know each other very well, they know each other's lives, they share a lot of personal information. If he was to have that Suboxone on him, I promise you that probably half a dozen people would know it.
Right. Well, the clinic he went to is not the, I don't believe it was the same clinic that I took him to, as far as, you know, trying to get him to help, because I talked to the doctor and they were explaining everything, and I'm into it. I was buying all this, you know. It was very expensive, the doctor's cost, and then the medication. I helped him. He was working in Alexandria, Louisiana with us up there. I'd take him all the way down just to get him help. And I found out, you know, if he went to the doctor 2 days prior, it might have been for other people, because, like I said, they get the money together, and they would let one person go to the doctor. You follow what I'm saying? And then they would take the pills or whatever. That's what I'm gathering. And because Zach didn't have any money. He really didn't have much, and his brother owed him money. And I don't know. I don't know what to say.
I certainly feel for you, but
I think what we can say, Christy, is that this group, BNN and our friends, will do absolutely everything we can to get a resolution.
Y'all have been wonderful trying to help me, and I appreciate it. It's just been phenomenal, and it makes me feel have confidence. I mean, I really felt alone trying to get help. I've been turned away on a lot of things. I went to the governor. I've gone to the attorney general. I've called the FBI. I've called state police. And I've done the protocol everybody I was supposed to go to. The chief of police of the sheriff's department, I talked to him on a conference call. And, I mean, I've done everything I'm supposed to do. I mean, I've gone to agencies, submitted all the information, and supposedly it's gotten lost. And I call back. I never get a return call. I mean, it's just nonstop. And I know it's frustrating. I know it's a lot of work, and I'm willing to do it, whatever it takes. Whatever it takes.
Okay, I just noticed that we've got another caller on the line, and it's none other than the infamous T.J. Hart.
Whoa.
He's obviously taking a break from doling out ice cream at the water park.
Hi, T.J.
Hello.
Happy
Fourth
of July.
Got rained on last night pretty hard when I was up getting up on the stage with the band, the Accelerators, at Red, White, and Blues with free ice cream. And no sooner than we got to the water park, another cloudburst, so I'm heading down to downtown Disney in Orlando for the last leg of this, and hopefully it'll be sunshine and rainbows and lollipops. So we got a big week ahead in the Haley case, looks like, or at least some activity anyway, with some courtroom drama, maybe.
We're just about to move on to that. TJ, I do want to introduce you to Christy. Christy, this
Hi.
Is TJ.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well, thank you.
Good.
Now, Christy's the mother of Zachary Pittman, who went missing in our backyard a year ago.
Oh, my heavens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, I'll tell you what, Christy, it has been delightful to have you on the show. I'm looking at the time ticking here.
Go ahead.
We do need to move on to a couple of other cases, but you can rest assured that we're not going to be dropping the search for Zachary.
No, I'm hoping to have one come up soon again. But y'all take care, and y'all have a good fourth, and I will
Thanks
be listening.
Thanks, you too.
Christy, y'all
be
take
sure
care,
you keep
okay?
in touch, okay?
I'll talk to y'all later. Thanks a lot, y'all, okay?
Thanks for calling.
Hi, bye-bye.
Okay, bye, Christy. Okay,
well, I sure hope the show can be a good help for that lady, too, because I tell you what, all parents of missing children need somebody on their side, and the show's been a good one so far.
Thank you. But, yeah, you're right.
Okay, TJ, what's new in the world of Haley Cummings?
Well, it appears that we have some court appearances coming up this week. I don't have my notes in front of me, but I'm thinking coming up on Tuesday, we have Tommy and or Ron will be making some court appearances. Don't know what's going to take place there, but there could be some, you know, the table is set for some interesting action and reaction, depending on what transpires. So a lot of eyes and ears will be focused on that here in Northeast Florida for this week. And, of course, we've not heard a whole bunch with our fine friends at the St. John's County Jail when it comes to the release of any video or audio material. And that, quite frankly, is a little disappointing. But as it's been explained to me, and I'm sure that it's been explained to you, too, from Sergeant Mulligan there at the St. John's County Jail, is that they've not really had a whole lot of visitors. Mom and Dad on the Crossland side just can't get over there to visit with them. I've not heard too much of Lindsay making any visits. And then, of course, Tommy's been moved over to Putnam County, and they don't have the camera recording equipment over there as well. But they do have audio equipment, but they, after one or two, maybe three recordings of Ronald's jail visits, they and calls, they've just stopped issuing those. But there's been a cost that's been a little bit prohibitive because now the TV and radio stations and newspapers don't appear to be too interested in the telephone calls in St. John's County. The charge is rather excessive because with only one, maybe two outlets making any requests for audio anymore, you know, they have to pay the full freight on that, as opposed to having that averaged down with all of the different agencies, you know, 20, 30, and 40 at a time, the way they used to. So it's been kind of up and down. It's all quiet before the storm, I believe.
Oh, yes. I mean, I do think it's going to be a very interesting week. Denny, yes. Have you been keeping tabs on what's going on?
No, I haven't, Simon. I've been anxious to listen today so I can get caught up.
Okay, Peter, I know you probably have your thumb on the pulse.
I have two words for you. James Werder.
Yeah, he's been making some noise.
Yeah, but I can't figure out, TJ. First of all, welcome back, TJ. We've missed you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, TJ, why he's speaking out, but I think he told us quite a lot this past week on one of the talk shows. He said two things. One, he said the body is in the river. The other thing he said was that Tommy is not guilty of felony murder. And neither of those statements were jumped on by the host of the show. He was allowed to just move on to the
hang there like low-hanging fruit, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And I think that was a slip of the tongue on his part. And I think that he revealed quite a lot to us. Not guilty of felony murder.
Does that mean it's accidental murder?
Does that
mean
manslaughter?
Yeah, that's the implication.
Yeah,
that's the implication.
Yeah,
that's the implication.
Of course,
that he's...
So you know,
go ahead, TJ.
Oh, I said, and then, of course, you know, Tommy's been getting kind of hassled in the Putnam County Jail, too, by the inmates. I mean, that's what happens when you want to make friends in general population with a case like that. You're going to get hassled.
I also saw that he had some personal contempt for Joe Overstreet, which was kind of unusual. I don't have the exact quote, but he said something to the effect of that Joe Overstreet is sitting there on his skinny Joe Overstreet. He mentioned Joe Overstreet's physical appearance, which I thought was quite unusual and quite personal. And his face expression was that of real contempt and animosity for Joe Overstreet. So I think that that by bringing up Joe Overstreet's physical condition, it reminded me that Tommy Crosland on recording had brought up his own physical condition, saying he's gained weight being off pills in jail there. Mm-hmm. And that between saying about the felony murder and then going off and getting angry about Joe Overstreet, I'm thinking that James Werder is not standing on good, solid ground in terms of his client and the status there. And I don't even know what his status is technically as an attorney. Has that changed? Is he representing Tommy in the Hayley Cummings case or just in the drug case?
I don't think that has changed, but by golly, he's sure acting like the mouthpiece and a misspeaking mouthpiece at that. But when he says my client is not guilty of felony murder, that's okay. the other side of that is open to any kind of interpretation.
Sure, and then he said that the body was thrown in the river. He didn't suggest it. He didn't ask it as a question. He said it definitively. And I think what we're getting here is I think we're getting an answer. I think that Tommy was involved. I think Tommy has real guilt in this, along with Misty. And then we can, of course, talk about Ronald's knowledge or whatever afterwards. But I think that some of the connections we have, including the cinder block, the rope, the river, I think these things are accurate. I think that we're starting to see the pieces come together.
Peter, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
You know, with your study on language and everything and what it means, what does felony murder mean? I mean, what's the other option? I mean, a murder is a murder, and I think murder is felony. A felony any way you look at it. There's no such thing as like an accidental murder. Was there something that this was supposed to be hinting at, or an admission like you think it really is, to some degree?
Yeah, you know, it was really strange because it's not like he's going to come out and say, well, this is a misdemeanor murder, you know. But I think
right.
What TJ hit it on the head is that he's in his mind, he's thinking, no, not felony murder, but manslaughter of some form, or criminally negligent homicide is another possibility. Aggravated child abuse, another possibility. But in his mind, I think that what he was telling us is that as far as Tommy's concerned, it wasn't premeditated murder. It was some form of manslaughter. But Tommy is absolutely hooked to this crime, and I think that the storm is about to hit us. I really do.
Well,
I hope so.
The one thing that I am absolutely firmly, firmly convinced of is that there is no way Tommy is going to get away with 3 years or be out by Christmas, as he seems to intimate in some of the audio tapes. I mean, he's going to get that same favorite number that everyone else is getting, 15.
I think he may see more. I think that if they're able to pile anything more on him, tell you what, Simon, if we were able to have Jim Water on, about the last thing I would do is interrupt him. I would let him speak and let him give this information. It was appalling to watch a television interviewer allow these things to go by. I mean, why does he have a need to ridicule the physical appearance of Joe Overstreet, for instance? What does that even mean?
Right. I mean,
it shows how weak.
Even I look better than Joe Overstreet.
But it shows how what kind of shape this attorney is in terms of his position. And here's where I have a question with him: is as it gets worse for him, does he bail out on the Haley Cummings case in terms of Tommy, or does he stick by him for both? As far as I can see, in terms of what he's revealing to us about himself, I think that he may try to get a deal for the drug case, but there will be no deal for Tommy Crosland regarding Haley Cummings' disappearance. And I think that Jim Warder may, with that personal animosity, he may bail out of this thing and say, this is not for me. I don't want this publicity.
Didn't he say before that he was going to be representing him in the drugs case, but not the Haley?
Yeah, he's flip-flopped a couple times in that, including, I think, two flip-flops within one 24-hour period. So, it you know, reminds me of Andrea Lyon, which, as you know, I had a little fun with that one back last May.
She's on the to-do list. Don't worry.
But I think it's the same cut from the same cloth. There is that Jim is protecting Jim's assets. Jim is personally angry because he was hoping to shade this off onto Joe Overstreet and has not worked out. Tommy has failed polygraphs. Tommy has not told them enough that they could make a deal. So this is a really bad loss. It's going to be a very bad loss for him as an attorney. I think he may bail out. I don't know for sure. I was quite certain with Andrea Lyon, but I'm not certain with I haven't had enough statements from him yet.
But you know, if this guy is working, let's say, on the drug deal pro bono, I mean, maybe that wasn't part of his original plan anyway. He's like, hey, hold on, I'll take care of you on this one, but let's not go there. If you've got problems with a murdered child, that's not what I plan on doing for you. I mean, he might have upfront said that to Tommy or whatever, you know. I'm out of here if that's the case.
Then if that's the case, he really shouldn't be going on national television talking about the murder case or the alleged murder case at this point.
Exactly.
I think once he stuck his toe in the water and he thought he'd get some publicity out of this thing, he may have found the water was full of sharks.
I'm inclined to agree. I mean, you know, basically, he made the fundamental error of sticking his head up, and now people are whacking it off with baseball bats. I mean,
that's a good analogy.
No, it's a stupid move. Yeah, and what is it that every defense attorney tells their client? Shut up. Do not talk to people. And what does Word do? You know, gets on national TV and makes this huge blunder. Now, earlier today or yesterday, I think it was, might have been, Jen and I were talking about it, and Jen said, oh, that's just lawyer speak.
Yeah, they usually do talk like that.
But, no. I mean, if you're on national TV, you dump the lawyer speak, and you try and talk in regular English. And,
I don't know. I don't agree with that, but if you say so.
Well, remember, a lawyer is a human being just as anyone else is, and when they go to say something, they're pulling their language from their internal dictionary, which they've developed since childhood, and within that dictionary, if we're listening, people are speaking. The problem is that no one is listening, and we all interpret instead of just stopping and listening to the words that they're choosing, because those words are telling us a great deal. And lawyers are no exception like that. They do throw around words like, I'm going to be honest with you, and well, you know, honest to God here, and you know, quite honestly, the reason they use those words is because they're used to schmoozing. It's a word from New York. They're used to schmoozing since the time they were children. So when they really want to be believed, they call out the horses, and they have these habits that they've gotten over the years of honest to God, swear to God, honestly now. And they reveal themselves as much as anyone else does. So I'm all for letting them talk. Let them talk, and I'll listen, and I'll know what they're saying.
Unfortunately, the avenue that allowed him to talk is that one avenue that never allows anyone to talk. I don't think I've ever heard that person actually permit a single guest to complete a whole statement.
That's
true.
Yeah, the one.
They build their reputations on drawing attention to themselves, and what happens is they'll often ask someone a long compound question. The subject is allowed to pick and choose whatever question is most comfortable for them, and then there's no follow-up. But the theatrics, the head bobbing, the hands raising, Nancy Grace has created a cottage industry of copycats on television and on radio, and they have all these wild inflections of the voice, and they have the dramatic bombshell breaking news. Tell you what, as far as I was concerned, that program did have breaking news, but it wasn't what they were saying. They let things go out there. What this guy, Jim Werder, was saying, that was a bombshell to me, because he knows, he has spoken intimately with Tommy Croslin. He has seen the results of the polygraph. He knows which questions were asked, which questions were not asked, which questions produced sensitivity, which ones didn't. He knows, and he told us. Tommy Croslin is part responsible for the death of Haley Cummings. That is what Jim Werder said on that program. He just doesn't believe it's premeditated murder. And that we'll hear something else. And I'm quite sure we're gonna come back to this date, and we're gonna remember that, yeah, this was talked about when they tried to plead down to criminal negligent homicide or aggravated child abuse or whatever probably TJ can address that more than I can at Florida law. It'll be something along those lines.
I think TJ's gone back to the ice cream scoop.
Well, I mean, wouldn't you think, though, that when the police went to the St. John's River and brought little Misty along to try and open her up, I mean, she was probably a little bit razzled by that when they brought out bones or whatever out of the river. Didn't you think that they made that trip because they do believe that maybe the girl was thrown into the river? So they have that much established. They just don't know exactly what happened to her.
Yeah, I think that they brought her there. I think they brought her there because they do know that's where poor little Haley was disposed of, and I think they were trying to, and I think it was a good move to trigger her emotionally. And I think they're running into a young sociopath who really doesn't feel much for anyone but herself, even at her young age, and they got no reaction from her. But yeah,
hey,
I think
we're
that
not
this
talking
is,
about Casey Anthony yet.
I'm getting all mixed up here. They brought her there. This is why the sheriff said, we're doing this and we're doing that. And then he stopped. He said, I'm going to go ahead and call this. Yeah, I'm comfortable with that. I'm going to call this a homicide. He took personal, first-person singular, responsibility for that statement. He has facts. He has information there that he has not disclosed. And I believe that they know this is what happened to her. This is where it happened. They need to find out a little more about Ronald's involvement. They're trying to pin down Tommy and Misty. Tommy and Misty are linked. Misty with her 911 call being deceptive. Tommy with him placing himself at the home. Tommy giving the details out. I think that when this comes out, the end of it, we're all going to look back and say, yeah, we knew about the rope. We knew about this. And Floral Hollers is something that really should be discussed. Floral Hollers was praised as a heroine for her bravery and everything else right on those programs. Mike Brooks and the others, that, oh, we admire your courage for coming on. And then this past week, they ridiculed her as a character. Oh, she's disappeared, and she's this, and she's that. These are the same people that were a month ago were praising her.
Well,
and she was repeating all
best.
These. I'm sorry?
I said that's what they do best, is
yeah,
praise them one day and ridicule them the next.
Yeah,
it's all for ratings.
As soon as they say something that they don't agree with.
Yeah, bombshell. Tonight, we have the fourth cousin three times removed of the mailman that might have delivered the last letter.
I'm sorry I interrupted you.
That's true, though. And they are grabbing the straw, so they'll take anything they can get.
I want to go to Denny. Denny, you've been awfully quiet. And you must have picked up on the comment that Werther made. What do you make of that?
I think somebody said that it may have been a slip of the tongue, and that could be entirely possible. I'm not sure what this guy's looking to accomplish, if it was an intentional use of the word as opposed to a slip of the tongue. I'm not quite sure what his game is or what he's trying to accomplish, other than put something out there, perhaps, that this was a negligent homicide, for example, criminally negligent homicide or something, as opposed to a deliberate intentional act of murder. I don't know, but it seems like he opened the floodgates here, and we've got to see what comes out of it.
I didn't phrase the question very well. I mean, do you just view it as lawyer speak, or it was a screw up?
I would, at this point, tend to think maybe it was a screw up. It could have been lawyer speak. He could have been planting the seed for something to say that he was involved in something other than an intentional, deliberate homicide. I don't know how sharp this guy is, so it's tough for me to say that it was done intentionally to plant some kind of a seed in the minds of the public. But an accidental slip of the tongue may be more in line at this point, but I could be wrong on that.
Well, look at the case with the Kaylee Anthony case. I mean, Chaney Mason got up there and said, we're not saying that Casey Anthony, I forgot his exact words, but that she didn't kill the baby, in other words. They're just saying she didn't deserve the death penalty. I mean, everybody said that was a slip of the tongue. I mean...
Yeah
that was in the courtroom.
Right, exactly.
That was in the courtroom. What he said at the post-hearing press conference was kind of interesting, too. But go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to point that out.
Saying the comparison... To me, I mean, could be both the same way, and either way.
Okay. We have a theory in statement analysis that there is no such thing as a Freudian slip, that whatever word that came out of someone's lips is what was in their mind. It was chosen in less than a microsecond, and listen to that word. Honest people will self-correct when they make mistakes, but the word that came out was in their mind for whatever reason. A man said to me recently, he was mourning the loss of someone that was really close to him, and he said, you know, he was my best friend at my funeral. I mean, my marriage, my wedding.
Yeah. Well, you're right about that, too, as far as going back and correcting yourself. And I've always heard that, too, you know, whatever you say is what's in your mind. So.
Okay. And
this is why.
Carry on.
This is why even in an interview when someone wants an attorney present, when I ask a question and that question has to be looked over to the attorney for guidance, I know that I've asked a sensitive question. So in a way, I'm getting the answers anyway. I've never cared whether an attorney was present or not, because if the attorney even needs to tell them to shut up, there's a reason they need to tell them to shut up.
Mm-hmm.
And even that speaks to me. So lawyer speak, I'm not a terribly big fan, as I mentioned last week, about Cobra and his reptiles. In terms of attorney, his motive, Jim Werder's motive, is immaterial in statement analysis. This is what he said. Let's open our ears because these are the words he chose.
I had to open my ears this morning. I did get a call from Cobra, and I'll tell you what, you have not heard the last of him. He's to quote a line from a June Carter Cash song, Jackson. He's hotter than a pepper sprout. yeah. more on that later. But this does give us a good segue into the Kaylee Anthony case. Okay, talking about big targets doing really stupid things. I want to hear what everyone on the panel thinks about Andrea Lyon. Now, it is part of court records that she did receive $20,000 before Baez went up cap in hand and declared indigency. Now suddenly the money's gone, and so is Andrea. Jan, you want to weigh in?
Well, we did say a couple of weeks ago that she was going to end up quitting before this was over with because she didn't want to ruin that little perfect record of hers. And, well, now you see it. So I figure it's because he's trying to make an excuse, saying it's because of financial issues and problems or whatever.
Yeah,
but
financial issues.
I don't buy that at all.
Yeah, financial issues. She's not getting the big bucks.
Yeah, so she don't want to be there because it won't be worth it to ruin her little record that she's got. But we knew she was going, from the beginning, we said that.
Dave, you must have a comment or 30 about Andrea Lyon.
Yeah, how much time do you have left? Well, you know, I will say this. I don't think that, I think that the money was a factor. That was one factor. I think that it came down to a battle of the intellects, you know, between Cheney Mason and Andrea Lyon. And, of course, she's in Chicago.
Are you trying to tell me Cheney Mason has an intellect?
Well, you know, I mean, to be fair and honest, yeah, I mean, he wouldn't have made it that far in life. I know what you're saying, and he is a blowhard and all that. But the thing is, I mean, I think, you know, he's definitely qualified when he went in. She also knew that Casey was in decent hands. So it wasn't just like that she was abandoning Casey. I don't think she left Casey because of any moral issue. I mean, you know, I don't mean to sound, bad about criminal defense attorneys, but a lot of times they don't have issues with morals, you know. They'll take on the lowest of the lows. That's what they, you know, that's what they do for a living. So I don't think it was, and they want everyone to get a fair shake. Regardless of whether they're guilty or not, they still want them to get the fairest trial. So I don't think that she left because of any morals. I think she left because the state JAC refused to pay for her airfare, lodging, whatever. So everything was going to come out of pocket. And you got a guy like J.D. Mason who's taking this. I mean, right away, he came out fighting. He's got a new direction he's taking it. Now we've got, you know, which I think I mentioned last week, there's a difference between missing and disappearing. You know, I'm missing my keys, but they didn't disappear from where I last left them. So, you know, you've got all that kind of language that's, you know, that's going on with Janie Mason. And I don't think that it's the same tack that Andrea wanted to go in. You know, that's just my opinion. I'd like to hear what everybody else thinks.
Peter.
But that's what I think about it.
Peter, weigh in.
Andrea Lyon quit because she doesn't like Casey Anthony. Andrea Lyon doesn't need the money. Andrea Lyon's probably not a fan of dealing with Jose Baez, and Andrea Lyon is more of a fan of Andrea Lyon. But her book, Angel of Death Row, tells us that many of the people that she was able to get off death row, she felt a certain emotional connection for. As you know, last May, I had written an analysis of
and
what
she said.
And that
was very good, too.
Thanks. She had said,
yeah.
People don't say, you know, she's a, it's an impolite word, but, you know, she's a whore, so she should die, right? They don't say that out loud. Oh, well, they do in their blogs, Your Honor. Then she said, but they don't say it here in court, but underneath, that's what's going on. In fact, who said that Casey is a whore in court? Andrea Lyon did. Who said Casey should die? Andrea Lyon did. So I took her words, the words that she chose that were in her mind, while she was defending Casey, and she, and of course the body language, Dr. Lillian Glass and others agree with this, she could not hide her disdain and contempt for Casey Anthony personally. So I'm not making any money. I'm not blowing my record. I'm not risking anything because she is a whore who killed her own child. And I think that Andrea Lyon probably has a type of heart that really, I'm sorry to say this about a lawyer, but I think that she cares passionately about these issues and about people. And I think she's stunned as she looks in the eyes of Casey Anthony, who was able to snuff out and abuse and murder her own child. And I think that she just had enough, and that was it. So, you know, at first I was saying all along that she would quit because of her perfect record and all that. But when she spoke these words in court, that's when I went on in writing and said, do not bet against this one. She is not going to last. And I think it was mentioned, Jan, a week or two previously. But
yeah.
Andrea Lyon, she has some maternal instincts going on there, and she cannot help but choose those words. She said, she's a whore. She should die. It reminds me of the words that people will use when they're guilty. They find a way to frame like this. Hey, you think I did it? Now, it sounds like they're answering your question, but within their words, they're saying, I did it. Did you know statistically, people that say, oh, so you think I did it, are extremely high on the probability that they did do it. People that are innocent don't generally use those words. It is very rare to find them using those words. So if you just go with the, you know, the 90-plus percent odds, and a person says, hey, you think I did it, by framing the words, I did it, they are likely to have done it. When Andrea could have worded this anyway, she could have said, Your Honor, people say really bad things about her. But she didn't. She went on and said, people say, you know, in their blogs, she's a whore. She should die. This is Andrea Lyon, probably, I believe, in a crisis of conscience where she herself may be reconsidering her views on the death penalty, because if anybody deserved the death penalty, it's someone that could take the cutest of cute two-and-a-half-year-olds and do what Casey did. And as Simon, as you know, and Jan, probably you know, and I know, Denny, you're aware, I think that Cindy and Casey have given us, by their words, some of Kaylee's last moments. And it is harrowing. And I think the prosecutor that laid that out for the court did an excellent job. He drove that home. And Casey mouthing, they say, make him stop, make him stop. I think it's an act. I don't think she feels anything except a little bit of delight that she's able to smoke her mother again with this stuff. So Andrea Lyon quit, not out of money, not out of being driven nuts by Jose Baez or watching the ego Janie Mason walk around. I think she quit because she didn't have it in her to defend this person who she can't even stand to be in the presence of.
That's a very, very interesting idea, concept. Denny, would you buy into that?
Yes, I would. And I would buy into it, but I want to know in the great scheme of things, what's everybody think? How much does this damage, if at all, Casey Anthony in her defense? Is this going to make a substantial difference? Is she more apt to end up in the hot seat now, the death chamber, or doesn't it, in the great scheme of things, matter a great deal?
That's
a good question. You know, may I?
Sure.
Cheney Mason said, and I quote, "You're really not going to notice any difference in the way the team operates." So I really think, you know, as much as I want to agree with that she quit, I don't think that she would quit any case that's a death penalty case. I think because she's so against the death penalty. I mean, maybe, you know, I can't say for sure, but one thing is certain: Cheney Mason could handle this without O.J. Baez. He could handle it without any other attorney on board. He's done so. So I don't think that that once she joined up, that Andrea Lyon was wrong for this case anyway. I mean, had Cheney Mason not joined this case, would Andrea Lyon still quit? That's a key issue here. You know, because it's easy to say now, because there's a replacement, oh, sure, she was going to quit all along. And I understand that, and I think that there might be some truth to that. But I don't think it was one singular thing. I think that she and Mason might have clashed at the same time, not always agreed on things. You know, and she kind of maybe thought, well, you know what? I'm all the way up here Chicago way. I'm not getting paid for this. You know, he's saying he can get her off his way. And it's not the way I planned on doing it. So you know what? You don't need me anymore. Bye. I think there might be some of that involved in it too, not just one single thing.
Yeah, I'm inclined to buy into that. That there has to have been a bit of a bang in her heads. Jan, you know, when we started to see all these people turn up pro bono, which apparently pro bono doesn't pay, and you know that's why. One of the reasons Andrea's out of it. Did you think that Andrea and Cheney Mason were going to...
get along?
Yeah.
No. Not in the least. From the first words that come out of his mouth, even before I knew anything about him, I could tell that. No, I don't think he... I never think that they would get along. So... is that what you wanted to know?
Yes. Yeah, I just wanted your opinion. Yeah, it was quite simple.
Very. There it is, then.
And I don't think Andrea Lyon liked that comment he made at the first press conference. She said, we're going to walk out arm in arm, in case. And it was like, boy, that was a really dumb statement from a high-profile attorney.
Well,
so,
what about him? I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Well, no, that's basically what I was going to say. That was kind of like, I don't think Andrea Lyon appreciated that kind of a comment, because if she puts herself on any kind of a level with Cheney Mason, maybe above at times, maybe slightly below, but they were kind of like on a level plane, then I think that Mason lowered his standards when he said that. She didn't like that, I'll bet you anything. So...
What I was starting to say though was that, what about the statement that he made? I don't remember the exact words. I'm not good at that. But about it, this was going to be fun.
Oh, that too. Yeah. Well.
Case.
Yeah, that's the day he said that too.
I didn't appreciate that one either, because I mean, even though I think Casey Anthony is guilty of sin, I don't believe that any murder trial at whatsoever should be fun.
No, the murder of a child.
That. Yeah. Right, it's
murder of a child is not fun.
Well, especially a child.
Take a look at what both Jose Baez and Cheney said about Andrea's departure, and we can learn a lot. Jose Baez said, "We're sad to see her leave, but we completely understand that it's a fiscal reason." So we have two words there that are weakening his statement. First of all, he starts off with "we." We're sad, not "I'm sad," to see her leave, but we understand. Nope, he didn't say that. He said, "We completely understand." The word "completely" is not necessary, therefore gives us additional information. He is weakening his assertion by saying that. Then he continues. He said that she will be fully accessible to us, plural, if we, plural, need her at any time. Not just accessible, but fully accessible. Again, these extra words are almost pleading and persuading, somewhat weakening. But you may say, hey, it's okay, he's speaking on behalf of the team. Then he says, he goes to the first person singular, he changes. He said, she would not have left if she felt it would affect Casey. I know that. And I'll tell you what, Jose Baez is telling you the truth. Her departure is not going to affect Casey. He didn't say, we know that. He says, I know that. As a matter of fact, we already have the answer from the team of attorneys. Will Andrea Lyon's departure, will it impact this case at all? And we know, not at all. She couldn't save her, and her departure is not going to change a thing. It's still going to go through as a slam dunk. And Jose Baez, at that point, first person singular, he's taken ownership of that. And then, of course, we have Chaney Mason, and he said, he had an interesting statement there. He said, you're really not going to notice any difference in the way the team operates. Notice he didn't say that he's not going to have any notice of any difference. He said, you're not going to. But then he didn't say, you're not going to. He said, you're not really going to, which tells us that we are going to see some. But he wasn't saying this for himself, and he wasn't saying it for Baez. He was saying this to the press, to the media, to us, that we're not really going to notice a difference. Casey is going to go down, and what they're telling us is that Andrea Lyon, the angel of death row, couldn't save her, and she's out, and it's not going to change anything.
Well, I think the strategy is going to be completely different under Chaney Mason. And you know, the fact that there was a slip of the tongue in the courtroom where he said something to the effect that we're not saying that she didn't kill her, we're saying she didn't murder her. That's really key right there. Are they now going to say that maybe in fact she did accidentally kill her down the road? In other words, let that slip in there, and that's like something they might be able to pull out of their pocket. Well, don't you remember? Don't you recall? And it's right there on your court transcripts when I made that statement. That was back in June.
Yeah, you're correct. Yeah. I think that Chaney Mason did say that, and I think it is an indication of where they're going to go. They can't raise reasonable doubt. They tried everything under the sun. So I think we're going to have a change of strategy. Whether Andrea was there or not, it wouldn't change anything, but they're going to now promote the accidental death theory. And would anyone like to talk about Hector?
Hector.
Simon, can we talk about Hector?
Sure.
Do you know anyone know who Hector is? I believe he's either the stepson or the stepbrother of Zenaida Fernandez Gonzalez, who's now in New York City with a living Kaylee Anthony.
Oh,
is this a breaking bombshell?
Yeah, of course.
Because Cindy said, if the dog exists, then Zanny must exist. And what she's doing, the same type of deception again. If Hector exists, then Zanny the nanny exists. I don't know if anyone saw some of the analysis done by Lillian Glass on that, but what she said was that Cindy was doing this not simply to raise reasonable doubt in the minds of the press, because she knew this was going to be read by people, but she is taunting her daughter. She knows that Casey killed to get revenge upon Cindy, and Cindy is taunting her back, which we've seen before, by saying, oh, I don't want to upset you, dear, but by the way, Hector and Zanny are living in New York City with Kaylee.
That's an interesting concept, because did you read any of those letters where she signed her letters to Casey in jail as Kaylee?
Which
is kind of like, well, you know, is that kind of taunting? I don't know. I mean, I think that at the same time, Cindy's having a terrible time adjusting to the fact that she doesn't want to believe that her grandchild is dead. She will not give out that one last ounce of hope. Know that she is still alive, and everyone's made a terrible mistake, and there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. But, you know, in real life, that's not the way it works. So, I see that in Sydney, too. I don't think that she's 100%. I think she's deceiving or deceptive, because she is of the belief that maybe Kaylee is still alive. One ounce of her whole body.
Yeah, and she can snub her nose at the Bank of America, because she knows if there's a payday coming for her that's going to be bigger than any of us on radio have ever been able to dream about. She's going to cash in big time. She knows what she's doing. Don't underestimate her intelligence. She's an intelligent woman. She may have no soul, or she may have no conscience, but boy, oh boy, she's got an intellect and she knows how to use it.
Yeah, actually, Peter, we had something like 5,000 pages of documents released, and I can honestly put my hand up in the air when asked the question, have I read them? No. But I know that you've plowed through lots of them, letters. What are you getting out of the letters?
With George, we're seeing something that is just so bizarre and disgusting. He is focused upon Casey's physical appearance. His daughter is on death row. She's facing lethal injection, and he grovels and he tries to manipulate to see her. He acknowledges that it's not about media that he can't see her, but it's Casey's own refusal. But he cautions her about getting fat. He advises her to exercise. I'm telling you, this guy, I believe firmly that he had molested his daughter at some point, because this is just a inexcusable and disgusting behavior on his part. And the analysis of his letters show that we've got a really, in the vernacular, we got a creepy guy in our hands here. With Cindy, we see something different, but I'll leave the comment about George's letters. If anyone can picture what you might say to your daughter had she been in prison facing a murder charge, I'm not sure any of us would focus upon their physical condition or call her terms that you would use for a girlfriend. She's a 22-year-old young woman.
I just can't fathom the thought of something like that happening. So I just find it hard to believe. I mean, I would never think of that. It's not something I could ever even imagine. So, you know, I kind of find it as something that I just don't want to believe in. I mean, I think I used to tease my ex-daughter about cooking fat, but that was all in jest. I don't know what it is with George, whether it's like a... you know what? I'm worried about your health. You're not looking good. And
I'd like to tell you,
but I don't think a father should really talk to his daughter that, you know, like that in a serious.
No, look. One of the words that he uses has absolutely set off shockwaves. He says, "Hey, beautiful, it was very exciting for Mom and I to see you. It was exciting." This is coming from his personal dictionary. This is coming from a man whose daughter is facing a lethal injection, who writes to her about her physical appearance. And,
well, wait
and,
a minute now.
Exciting? Exciting?
Well, I mean, look, I'm excited to be on the show with you and Simon, but I don't want to have sex with Simon.
Right, but you're also not employing language where you're describing people's
no.
physical attributes.
Well, I just wondered if that was like a touchy-feely. Was he a touchy-feely kind of a sensitive guy? I mean, I don't know. I don't know the family dynamic stuff.
Let's go with that. Say he's a touchy-feely guy. This woman was able at a young age, so not only was she sexually promiscuous, but she was able to overcome all the barriers, all the natural instincts of loving and protecting a child. Women her age with children will throw themselves in front of a car to save their child's life. She was able to not simply put her hands on her, but she was able to keep her hands on her and snuff out her life, breaking all those social mores, breaking all those barriers, breaking all those instincts. The reason that she would have the ability to do such a heinous crime, the idea of a mother being able to kill a child, is, I believe, because she has suffered a violent upbringing with trauma that was likely sexual in nature. And then we have a dad who describes her in ways that maybe you would use those words to your 5-year-old when she's wearing a communion dress or Even men whose daughters are going to the prom don't use these type of language. But given the context,
wasn't she a little bit more vague about George? But she asked someone to point a finger at Lee. You know, Lee hasn't come out and denied it either. You know, or anything. So she didn't come right out and say my father molested me.
That's correct.
She said, well, you know, my father may have. I don't remember or whatever. But I remember my brother touching me that way and complaining to my mother. She never complained to her mother about her father. So I think there are things that you could read into that too. I mean, I don't think.
You know what was more vague than her description of the molestation was George's denial.
Yeah, I don't know.
More vague than anything.
Well, I think that he denied it or whatever because he had the back and forth in that letter. I think that was the way he basically said, what are you trying to do?
He's been on television. Simon, had you been accused of something this horrific, or Denny, or me, or anyone else, there is nothing, no threat from a lawyer, no threat from a TV producer, there is nothing that's going to stop you from saying, no, I didn't molest my child.
Right.
Nothing is going to stop you.
What you're going to say.
But that's the one thing that George couldn't say. That's the one thing he couldn't say. And that's the simplest of all. So he can be hurt, and he can be devastated, he can ask why. What do you mean, why? How about, no, this didn't happen. Okay. This family is bizarre.
I'd like to know. I mean, isn't it kind of odd that she's going to say the two men that lived under her parents' roof molested her? They're the only two guys, of course, that lived there. But isn't it kind of odd that she's going to claim suddenly, after all this time, that they molested her?
No, I don't think the timing means anything, and I don't think it will mean anything in the penalty phase. I don't think it's part of a plot. I think Baez will probably try to use it, and he had to go and break the news to George and that sort of thing. But the very simplest thing is that if you are accused of this, the most natural thing an innocent person will say is, no, I didn't do that, it didn't happen. Why does Casey hate Cindy with such intensity that she was willing to kill her own daughter to stick the knife in Cindy's heart? Did Cindy fail to protect her? Did Cindy fail to protect her? And then I look at little Kaylee waking up in strange beds. God knows, I don't even want to go there, about what may have happened to her and all those, with all the drugs and the alcohol and these strange people that she woke up in bed with. We learned that Kaylee woke up in bed with these guys. Casey, in her mind, might think to herself, yeah, well, I went through it. It wasn't so bad. What's the big deal? Or she could have been one of those maternal killers. There's different categories, but one of them that says, I'm going to save my child from what I suffered through. I don't see Casey as being that type. And I don't know that Casey was molested. I don't know that for a fact. If I heard more of her own language, I might be able to draw a stronger conclusion. I am very strongly of the opinion that the dysfunction in that family is wrapped around sexuality and violence.
Let Jan have a go.
He knows this is very close to my heart. I mean, personally, I would think that as far as the violence in the house, I honestly think that it comes from Cindy Anthony. And when Casey was pregnant with Cindy, she really wanted an abortion. I mean, with Kaylee, she wanted an abortion, but her mother is the one that insisted that she didn't. And she practically forced her to have the baby. And then I think the build-up in Casey come after that. Because they said before this that they had a good relationship or so-so. I mean, as much as a mother and daughter and family can have. But it was Casey changed once the baby come along. And she was seeing, because Cindy gave all the attention to her, to Kaylee, instead of Casey. And Casey was always, always used to getting what she wanted, as being the only girl in the family. And she was spoiled rotten to begin with. They got her out of everything she ever got into. They were right there to support everything she did. And now all of a sudden they were forcing her to be a mother to this precious little girl that she didn't want to begin with. And that can definitely force you to do things that you don't normally do.
Yeah, Jan, could I ask you a question, too?
Sure.
Because I think that being a you know, a mother and all, you might have more of a you know, grasp of this. I mean, if I was Casey and my father molested me when I was young, why would I want to leave my daughter with my covered,
there's no way.
No, I mean, and she never had any problem doing leaving her daughter.
No, she didn't. I would never. I mean, like you said too, this isn't just her father. This is her brother too. Why
it's a failure to protect.
There's no way I would do that.
Yeah, the pattern of failure to protect is generational. As you and I might say, why would in the world would anyone do that? The pattern goes on and on and on. And it's the courageous victims that come forward and put a stop to that pattern. They recognize the pattern. They see the propensity for it, and they put a stop to it. And they're the ones that I think are very, very passionate about this case because there are victims out there.
I think if she's going to go down, she's going to take everybody down with her. I think that's her
mindset.
I think so, too.
You know, I think it's more of that than anything else.
Yeah,
you know, she hated her family.
She's very selfish.
She
doesn't want to be the only one. It's just like with Cindy. She's telling her in those letters that I read, oh, how good Mallory's doing. It's a blessing to have Mallory there for Lee.
Ooh.
But she's a part of the family, and she's rubbing this into her. And she knows what a jealous person that Casey is. And she's doing this to her, and it's like eating her inside. And, I mean, I know... This is the kind of things that drives her to do what she does, and it's her mother. Her mother is her worst enemy.
And who held the baby first? I mean, that was probably the first. That's where it started, right there.
Right.
And then it went downhill from there because all of a sudden the baby got the attention, like you said, no more for Casey. Although they still protected her, God knows why, but they, you know, they kept lying for her, protecting her, paying off what she took, you know, everything. So, but I think she wasn't getting that that emotional support. They were backing her up when she stole or whatever, but they weren't giving her that same loving attention that they were now giving to Kaylee. But I think that's probably partially not true. I think Casey took it that way. You know, now you love her more than you love me, like a child would say. You know, now that you know she's around. Yeah.
Denny, you've been incredibly quiet. You like to think and contemplate. What's your comments?
Well, I hope they're right here. I hope that if Casey goes down, and I think she will, I hope she does, that she takes some more of them with her, because I think there's blame to go around here. I don't think it's, and I'm not making excuses for Casey. She did what she did, and she needs to pay for it. But I think there were some contributing factors to it, and this whole thing with George and Cindy and all this. I hope it all comes out, and I hope the people that need to be held responsible are held responsible. So I'm very encouraged that that may happen. I hope it does happen, and I think it should happen.
Yeah, and I have a sneaking suspicion that, as in other cases, what's going to be coming down the pike here is we're going to leave everything alone until we have this case, you know, this Casey case, you know, under wraps. You know, we've got it signed, sealed, delivered. And then watch out. I honestly believe that George and Cindy, possibly Lee, and maybe some other folks have a big shock waiting for them.
You know, I hope so, because they deserve it.
People got some explaining to do, Simon. A lot of explaining to do when this is over with.
They certainly do. Actually, I'm going to go off on a wild tangent just for 30 seconds. This is a story that needs to be shared. Yesterday, I put out a story, and it got back to PCSO, and I received an email from the... Chief Waller on the Haley Cummings investigation. I don't believe that he actually read my story. I believe that someone had contacted him about it, and they had got the news wrong, and that was that I had a credible lead. He reached out to me, and he said, "Hey, there's no one in the office. If you've got a lead, you send it to me. I will work on it this weekend." And I wrote back and I said, "Whoa, sorry, you know, you've been misled. The lead is actually involves another case, but it goes to show just how much these people care." And I was really, really damn impressed.
Yeah, well, I was too. I was really shocked.
And
which article was he talking about?
Oh, I think it was just the ad for this particular program. We did receive a lead on the Zachary Pittman case, and that had to have been the only thing he was talking about. But you know, it goes to show that you know law enforcement is trying and. You know, but there's been a lot of people that have beaten up on Ellie, particularly over the Haley Cummings case. But there are people out there that really, really do give a damn. And this is one of them. I won't name him because I don't think I should. But I was absolutely flabbergasted. Anyway, back to I just wanted to share that with everyone, you know, because
well, that was a nice thing to share, Sam.
Yeah,
nice
I mean,
to hear that on occasion.
Right. I mean, you know, it's so easy to, you know, sit here as armchair quarterbacks and go, "Oh, they dropped the ball here. Oh, they should have done this. They should have done the other." But no, you know, they care. Okay. Someone got fired this week. I believe they got fired on Friday. It's not a name that likely will, you know, spring any synapses. Sylvia Hernandez. Anyone know who she is?
Yes.
Okay. Dave, who is she?
Yes.
What did she do?
She was
Why did
a,
she get fired?
Well, she was a jail guard at the Orange County Jail, and she handed letters back and forth between Casey and her jailbird buddies, So, which is against policy, and she became friendly with Robin Adams, who was serving the continued term. She said since been moved to a state prison, but you know they became friendly, and this woman used to let them out of their jail cells. I understand. So it was against policy all the way around, and it was just a matter of time before they had no choice but to let her go. But I will say this: her record was outstanding and impeccable up until the day they called her to attack. So that's who she is.
And she was essentially the post lady.
Yeah, the go-between. Yep.
That was passing.
And I'm sure she really resents what she did now. She only has herself to kick. But, you know, it's almost like anybody that seems to go near Casey Anthony gets some kind of curse, some kind of an onus on them. You know, I mean, it's happened to everyone that I can think of. So
everybody she talks to seems to get in trouble.
Yeah.
Peter,
Peter,
where do you see the Casey Anthony trial headed? Are we going to see Baez crawling back to Judge Perry and saying, "Oh, well, you know, our defense team's been decimated. We're going to need another 10 years.
he may try because the fact that he went out to say we want a room, we don't want the investigators around and that kind of silly stuff. I think that he's not going to get any leeway from the judge regarding time. I think that even if Baez himself were to quit, that court date is going to go forward regardless, because other people who are accused of murder don't get this long, lengthy time period. I think that we're going to go down to the end. I guess at this point, I've learned from this program that the opinion is strong that prosecutors are not going to give a plea deal, and it looks like he's not going to seek it either. But I think that what was said earlier, that there's going to be a scorched earth policy that is going to take down everybody. And I think that what you said about things falling down upon George, Cindy, and Lee, I think when they go to cash in those chips, when they go to make that big bucks, we may see charges brought up against them, including tampering with evidence and that sort of thing, perjury, et cetera. I don't understand Lee's immunity. I don't know what that is actually and officially, but I think they're all going to be in hot water.
Oh, I think they're going to be in huge hot water. And if there's any plea deals to be handed out, Baez should be the first one in line.
You know what? I think that they're going to move the trial closer at least by a week, because Andrea had her daughter's graduation to go to the first week of May. And the judge, Judge Perry, let Judge Strickland's big stand because of that. And now with Andrea gone, would the judge be more inclined to move it back a week? I mean, this judge wants to get it over with, so he's not going to be playing any games. And, I wouldn't be surprised if he shores things up even before that, and you can't use Andrea Lyon as an excuse any longer to postpone it. So that's just my opinion, of course.
I think he has to walk a thin line in that he has to be fair, but he has to rein them in. You know, in as far as, you know, that not going to give you any wriggle room for an appeal. Although, you know, there's obviously at least one appeal already that I can think of, you know, incompetence. But let's not go there. I'm pretty certain that there's going to be a guilty verdict. I'm not sure that they can make the death penalty stick. I just can't see that. All you got to do is have one juror that's a holdout, and you're screwed. But
well, there's going to be. I think you're right, but I think that they're going to try everything they can to get all this circumstantial evidence. The smell of death, you know, the testing, they're going to have their own experts come in and say, look, the state got it all wrong. The tests aren't reliable or whatever. And that's all. They got to get to basically one. They got to get to two, because 6-6 wouldn't cut it. So they got to get another person to say no. No, I don't. But they're going to have a death penalty qualified jury anyway. So they've got that going in. But in the end, I think it's just to try and disprove any of the evidence and case that not get the death sentence.
Yeah, actually, just for everyone's edification, we are running an experiment. The whole smell of death thing and it being a pizza. I have put a piece of pizza in the back of my stepson's car, and we're going to let him drive around for a couple of weeks and see what he has to say about it.
Oh, he ain't going to like us. Oh gosh.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to try the old pepperoni in the club pot.
I think
yeah,
there 31 days.
On
yeah, there was pepperoni. Yep.
Yeah.
Pepperoni and sausage.
Yeah, it should be nice.
Was there sausage too?
And we do have, you know, 90-plus degree weather every day, and it's nice and humid. I think it should fairly well reconstruct the situation.
Yeah.
Oh, and imagine that car sitting out in the sun all that time, and what it's like in the trunk of a car in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
It's just unimaginable.
Oh yeah.
So.
But will it smell of death? And the answer is no. It's going to smell of rotten pizza. Cindy Anthony is a registered nurse. She's been around death. She knows the difference between rotten pizza and death. I mean, where'd she come out with this silly idea? Peter.
Well, you know, as I said before, we need no training for the smell of human decomposition. It initiates the gag reflex. It's something that gets into the clothing, into fabrics. It won't be mistaken for a dead animal. It won't be mistaken for rotting pizza. Had you never received any training, had you never smelled it before, when you come in contact with it, you know instinctively what it is. So Cindy did say that that maybe somebody put a body in the car after Casey had it, and that's an acknowledgement of the smell of decomposition. The case is sealed in every which way. I don't think there's an avenue for them to go in other than accidental death.
Okay, we're running out of time here. I do want to go around the panel and get everyone's thoughts on the three cases that we talked about. Jen, I'm going to start with you.
Well, with the Kaylee case, we are practically 100% sure we have who did it, who killed her. So, I mean, it's really kind of hard to not focus on Haley and Zach. Both of them have been missing for over a year and seems to be nowhere close to finding wherever they are, what happened to them. So that's what we need to focus on and try to find out what happened to these two. And, I mean, Haley's a child. Zach is a grown man with a 3-year-old daughter. Neither one of them should be put ahead of the other because of their age. But at the same time, your heart goes to both of them. I mean, you don't know who to think of more, so how can you think of one and not the other in our case? But we're just praying that both of them, is going to be found and they'll receive the justice that they need. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's all right. Peter, your thoughts?
Well, I'm glad that you're getting involved in the Zachary case, and I hope we're able to help them any way we can. I think on Casey Anthony case that when Casey goes down, I think it's going to bring a lot of casualties with her. I don't think that Mason was going to get anything more than a black eye on his reputation, but I think Jose Baez is going to have a comeuppance that's not going to be pretty, along with George, Cindy, and Lee. And I think we should probably prepare for some real interesting information to come our way in the Haley Cummings case. I think that we have, with the courts coming up, the court dates coming up, along with James Werder talking more, I think we're going to have some real interesting things happen within the next 4 weeks. So I think we should stay tuned.
Yeah, so do I. Denny, your parting thoughts.
Yes, I'm on board here, I think, with what's been said pretty much. I think the Haley case, hopefully everybody's right and things are due to break in the next few weeks. It would be certainly long past due. The Zach case, I hope, Simon, you and Peter can maybe help Christy out and discuss these questionnaires and possible interviews and stuff, because something needs to get off dead center there. And I hope the police carrying this as an open, even though it may be in an active case, doesn't doesn't obstruct any efforts you guys may or the mom might be using to try to get the case going.
Actually, there was a very amusing part yesterday. We went to the house where Zach was last seen, and his father lives there. And I was chatting with him. Everyone else had disappeared. And a young lady came in and said, "You're Simon. Wow, I got to shake your hand."
Beautiful. And I hope that works out, because these what the families go through with these missing persons cases or deceased cold cases are amazing. You know, it's just incredible what the family has to suffer through. So I certainly hope there's some resolution. And I'm fired up about the Anthony case. I really hope it's true that those people that need to be held accountable before this is all over, before the dust finally settles, I hope they're taken to task for whatever involvement they may have had. So
I really want to thank everyone for taking part in the program today, and I want to thank our listeners. If you have any information about any of these cases, our email is always open. I'm sure that we'll be talking again next weekend. Till then, have a great 4th of July. This is Simon and Jan Barrett wishing everyone the absolute best day.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Simon. Jan.
Till next
Happy
time.
Fourth.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.